10, which we had up for work session today, that we still do not have our amendments ready, so we're going to postpone that till next week. But what I'd like to do is open a public hearing on House Bill 3009. You have Mr. Gary Bauer?
I said I'm gonna get this.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Gary Bauer, representing Northwest Natural. With me this afternoon is Mr. Lee Sparling of the Public Utility Commission staff. Rather than go through my testimony, we have been working with the Public Utility Commission and some of the consumer groups regarding House Bill 3009, and as a result have developed a set of amendments which are attached to my comments. What we would respectfully request is that you allow us to work from the plenum to have those amendments drafted by Legislative Council and then come back to the committee and go through this. I could highlight some of those if you'd like at this time.
Okay, so you're in belief, both of you are in belief you have some amendments worked out. You simply have to get the language drafted into LC draft form, bring it back to the committee as an amendment. And at that point, there shouldn't be any disagreement in terms of the language for this bill.
We believe we've identified all those and all the parties that had disagreements and taken care of those.
Okay. Mr. Sparling, anything you want to add to that?
No, sir.
Okay, so is there any questions from the committee at this point? Would you just as soon wait until this bill comes back with the amendments?
Wait a second.
Okay, we'll hold this bill over until you have the amendments and bring them back, and then we'll review them at that time.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Is there anybody else who would like to give any testimony on House Bill 3009?
No, 3009, and we're also not doing work session because the amendments aren't ready.
Oh, it's Mr. Van Cleve. Van Cleve, did you want to start?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm Brad Van Cleve, and I'm appearing today on behalf of the industrial customers of Northwest Utilities, which is a nonprofit trade association that represents large energy users in the Northwest. I have submitted some written testimony, and I won't repeat it. I would just like to state for the record that ICNU opposes House Bill 3009 in its original form. We've had a brief opportunity to look at the amended version that Mr. Bauer proposed, and it appears to have some significant enhancements from the original bill, and I'll point those out quickly. First, it's limited to natural gas. Second, it provides a mechanism to refund overpayments. It also provides an opportunity for hearings, and it establishes the exact remedy that a utility can request under this bill. And we would not oppose the bill based on these amendments.
You would not, based upon the amendments? Okay, so your opposition is to the bill as it's currently written, but not based upon your understanding of the amendments that are being worked on?
That's correct.
Okay. Any questions for Mr. Van Cleve? Okay, thank you. Mr. Bissonnet?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jeff Bissonnet, representing the Citizens Utility Board of Oregon. Just wanted to state for the record that in its current form, we would also oppose House Bill 3009, but we're encouraged in the direction that the amendments are headed and look forward to coming back and talking with you in more detail once those are fleshed out.
Okay, great. Well, we'll welcome the testimony from either of you if you want to come back when those amendments are offered. Any questions for Mr. Bissonnet? Okay, thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Is anybody else who would like to give any testimony on House Bill 3009? If not, I will close the public hearing on House Bill 3009, and we're going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2729. Dan, would you give us a brief overview of that bill, please?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2729 permits individuals, corporations, and other business entities to claim either the qualified research or an alternative research activities tax credit on the tax return. It expands the definition of qualified research to all fields of research conducted in Oregon, increases the percentage of the qualified research tax credit from 5% to 20%. It changes the computation for the alternative research tax credit from basing on Oregon sales to an incremental computation based upon average annual gross receipts and the increase in the qualified research expenses, sets the maximum tax credit limitations for both methods at the sum of $500,000 plus 25% of the excess over $500,000 before subtraction of the research tax credit. Current Oregon tax law permits only corporations to claim the research tax credit for the amount of the increase in research conducted in certain technical fields, i.e. advanced computing, high-value materials, biotech, electronic device technology, environmental technology, and straw utilization. Oregon law mirrors most of federal law in the qualified research tax credit for corporations, with some exceptions. To qualify for the Oregon qualified research tax credit, the research must be conducted in Oregon. Federal law has no requirement. Oregon limits the qualified research tax credit to 5% of the increase in expense of research. Federal law limits this to 20%. Oregon's alternative qualified research tax credit is based upon a constant amount of the increase in qualified research expenses. Federal law provides for an incremental and progressive computation of that same tax credit. Proponent states that alignment of Oregon and federal laws governing qualified research tax credit will provide additional incentive for individuals, corporations, and other business entities to conduct research and development within Oregon.
Thank you. If we can have Fawn McNeely, Jim Craven, and Gary Conkling, if you'd all be willing to come up as a panel, we'd appreciate that. Feel free to start in whichever order you'd prefer.
Well, I'll go first. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Jim Craven, representing the American Electronics Association. AEA is the nation's largest high-tech trade association, and here in Oregon we have 170 member companies in the electronics manufacturing and software businesses. We're here today to urge you to basically move House Bill 2729 along. This bill was referred to this committee. It does have a subsequent to the House Revenue Committee, where I am confident it will receive additional work and analysis. So that's just the context of the vote we're urging today, is for this committee to, you know, give a nod on the policy and then move it along in the greater context of all the various tax expenditure bills that will be considered by revenue. Oregon's research and development tax credit was first approved under Governor Neil Goldschmidt as part of efforts in the late 1980s to help spur economic development in Oregon. The tax credit was one of the signals that Oregon sent to the country about its intent to diversify its economy. And Oregon certainly has succeeded in that goal. Since 1989, the high-tech industry in Oregon has more than doubled its employment and has expanded outside its traditional base in Washington County. Today, the high-tech sector in Oregon employs 73,000 workers with an average wage of $61,000, has a payroll of $4.5 billion annually, and annual exports of $5 billion. Now, was the R&D tax credit solely responsible for this growth? Well, of course not. But it was one of the signals and part of the package that Oregon offered to firms to signal that Oregon was receptive to the growth of high-tech economy. The Oregon R&D tax credit, which, as your staff point out, is similar to a federal incentive, only impacts the state's general fund when it works exactly as planned. And that is, the credit is only for those research expenditures which a company increases over a base year determination. So it's not an entitlement for doing the same thing year after year. Only when a company increases its research expenditures here in Oregon does the credit come into play. So thus, it's one element of the tax code, one tax credit that you will consider this session that actually is guaranteed to work and work as it's planned. Attracting and retaining innovative companies that pay high wages is an important goal for Oregon. Not only do the individual employees and their families benefit from such jobs, but certainly the state's general fund profits, as it were, from corporate and personal income taxes paid. And as we enter what certainly looks like a time of some slowing of growth, hopefully not negative growth here in Oregon, it's important to continue to send such positive messages to the companies that are here, and to those companies that are considering coming here, that Oregon is still open to business. House Bill 2729 does make some some substantive changes in the current law regarding the R&D tax credit. Some of those will be spoken to in a moment here, and I'm certain that some of them will receive further analysis in the House Revenue Committee. We also do understand that this tax credit extension, unlike some others that are up for renewal this session, is contained at least at the base amount within the governor's budget. And in the governor's tax expenditure report, he did give a thumbs up to this credit as one for which he would support an extension. So I think that's important to note. In conclusion, I just want to cite a statement from the 2001-2003 Oregon tax expenditure report. According to that report, quote, this expenditure appears to achieve its purpose. The report goes on to note that the credit might convince companies to relocate to Oregon. It encourages companies to put more efforts into R&D here in Oregon, encourages small companies to explore niche technologies, and encourages companies to utilize existing state research institutes to assist with their R&D activities. In conclusion, that's an important point to note, that this credit is not just for expenditures that companies undertake within their own company, but can also be used to support research partnerships with institutions of higher education. And as we move forward in another of other bills and other committees to talk about technology transfer and university private sector partnerships, we think that this credit can continue to play a role in achieving those goals. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Craven. We would like to go next. Vaughn, would you like to go next? Or Gary?
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, I'm Gary Conkling, appearing here today on behalf of Intel in support of House Bill 2729. Oregon's R&D tax credit serves as an important signal to Intel of the state's interest in encouraging R&D activities here. As many of you are aware, Intel's largest site in the world is located in Oregon. And like most successful high technology companies, Intel invests heavily in R&D. Because roughly 60% of the Oregon site is R&D oriented, that's good for Oregon because it means Intel will invest in the Oregon site even during periods of economic slowdown such as we are experiencing today. In Intel's case, we've responded to the state signal by conducting significant levels of R&D in Oregon. That, in turn, has led to new products in microprocessors, networking, telecommunications, handheld computing devices, and personal computing system components that are designed or manufactured here, producing jobs, economic opportunity for other Oregon businesses, and local and state tax revenue. The positive stimulative effect of the R&D tax credit is what we feel prompted the governor to recommend extension of this provision in his budget. We ask you today to move House Bill 2729 along in the process, as Mr. Craven has indicated, recognizing that additional work is needed for its passage, but recognizing that it's a valuable tool for the state's economy. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Conklin. Vaughn, did you want to add something?
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Vaughn McNeely, and I'm here representing the Smart Growth Coalition. The Smart Growth Coalition includes Adidas, Columbia Sportswear, Intel, KinderCare, Louisiana-Pacific, Nike, Tektronix, and Schnitzer Steel. We're committed to developing a stable and diversified economy in Oregon, and believe 2729 helps achieve that goal. House Bill 2729 restructures the research and development credit in the state of Oregon. Currently, only businesses doing research and development in certain areas can qualify for the tax credit. The goal of this bill is to let all businesses doing research and development who qualify for the federal credit to also qualify for the state credit. House Bill 2729 also raises the cap on research and development. The current cap, when compared with research and development caps in other states, does not encourage businesses to locate research and development facilities here. We believe that Oregon needs more family wage jobs. Research and development facilities can be a great source of those family wage jobs. Currently, there are a number of multi-state companies who do not locate research and development facilities in our state, but have a presence here. Our coalition believes that if you change the structure of the tax credit to be more attractive to businesses, more companies will take advantage of the tax credit, bringing better jobs and a stronger economy to our state. Thank you for your time. If you have any questions, we'll be able to answer them right now.
Yeah, I'd like to ask a question, probably directed to you, Jim. The way this bill is proposed, how much of a stimulating effect do you think this would have in terms of bringing more research and development type activities into Oregon?
Well, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, tough to say this bill alone at this level would attract X amount of jobs for instance. I think what it would do, and what we've certainly seen that the federal R&D tax credit has helped, if you take the nation as a whole, has helped preserve R&D within the shores of this country, as opposed to, I mean, people have choices. People have choices to move offshore and to locate facilities in a multinational economy. So, you know, I think it is a stimulating piece of a picture, and I think that's the way it needs to be looked at in terms of a number of other signals. We have a couple of large-scale tax incentives for business in this state. We don't have very many that encourage sort of the mid-level company to do something different in Oregon as opposed to elsewhere, and the R&D tax credit is one of that. We have large-scale property tax credits, but we don't have much in the way of business activity incentives.
How does Oregon compare with other states in the West relative to tax credits or other incentives for research and development investment?
Mr. Chair, I can bring you a chart. I'm sorry I didn't bring it with me here today. I think I do have a chart that shows the various different states and the different credits. California has actually a large-scale investment tax credit, which is much broader than the R&D component. They're currently considering raising that from 6% to 7% down in California. Washington State, because they don't have the income tax credits, you know, has different kinds of incentives. Washington usually tries to chip away at the sales and use tax vis-a-vis business because they don't have a corporate income tax. So it is a different situation in different states, but I do believe somewhere back at the home office I've got a chart that shows R&D credits by all the states. We can get that to you.
Okay. Other questions? Representative Walker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't see a fiscal impact in here, and I noticed that you want to expand the tax credit. Do you know what the impact on the budget is, either of you?
I'll wait for Dan.
That's fiscal. That's not revenue.
Right. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, what I was told is that since the revenue impact statements are prepared by the revenue committee staff, one of the reasons for this hearing is today is to get the vehicle in their hands, at which time they will do the analysis.
Yeah, Representative Walker and members of the committee, what I'd like to do with this bill today for the purposes of this committee is focus on the policy of this. I haven't asked for a revenue impact statement on this. I mean, we could have, but I didn't. This bill, if we pass it along to revenue, they'll have to deal with that, and they'll get the revenue impact on it and kind of wait, bring that into the equation of weighing the policy in the revenue committee, which I think is the appropriate place to do it. But I'd like the committee to try to focus on the policy of this. Does this make sense in terms of policy without worrying right now about the dollars?
Well, Mr. Chair, if I could respectfully disagree with you, because to me it's always important to talk about policy and money together. And my next question was going to be, do you want this credit or do you want the pollution control tax credit? We can't have all of these. So, I mean, I'm willing to pass this bill along to revenue, but I don't want to make a recommendation because I don't think that we can do that without knowing what the impact is on the budget.
Sure, that's fine. I appreciate your position, Representative.
Other Chair, Representative Walker, just one comment. I'm not here to trade credit against credit. Just to note that this is one that truly does work in terms of leveraging activities. One can argue about other tax credits, whether they, quote, reward behavior that would take place otherwise. The R&D tax credit only kicks in if a company does what you want them to do, which is increase their R&D tax credit over a base year and leverage much more in terms of investment in the state than is forgiven by this 5% tax credit.
Thank you.
Okay. Any other questions? Okay, thank you. We appreciate your testimony.
Thank you.
Anybody else who would like to give testimony today on House Bill 2729? Okay, I will close the public hearing on House Bill 2729. Do we know where Representative Canope went off to? Or Representative Carlson or Representative Garai? Would you go grab them and tell them we're going to go into work session? Okay, I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 2729. And Representative Cromwell?
Mr. Chair, I would move House Bill 2729 to the Revenue Committee with a due pass recommendation.
Okay, Representative Crummell has made a motion to move House Bill 2729 to the Revenue Committee with a due pass recommendation. Do we have some discussion on the motion?
Yes.
We're in work session, gentlemen. We have a motion to move the bill to Revenue. Representative Walker.
Well, I'll just restate my position. Given the explanation, I think this may be a good credit, but I can't say it is when we have all these other tax credits floating around out there. I'd be happy to refer it and let the Revenue Committee make that decision. So if it's going to have the due pass hooked onto it, I'm a no.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Walker. Other discussion? Representative Bates?
I would just say, no, this looks like good policy, but I might change my vote in Revenue depending on what the impact is. That's just
you have the advantage of being on the Revenue
Committee. I'm on Revenue, so I can say that. It's a good place to discuss it there, I think. It'll be an interesting discussion.
Okay. Any other discussion? I'm supportive of this bill, and I appreciate Representative Walker's comments, but, you know, I certainly will explain to Representative Shetterly when this bill gets to Revenue that we passed it based upon support for the policy and that we did not have the numbers. But I appreciate your position, Representative Walker. I think one of the things we have to keep in mind is that Oregon is not doing as well as economically as most of the other states in the West. And in fact, we're at about 96% or 97% of per capita national income. And that it's very important that we have policies that will attract more investment into Oregon, particularly the type of investment that this bill is designed to stimulate, which will lead to greater productivity and higher wage-paying jobs throughout the state. So I think this bill moves in the right direction. I think in the long term, this bill more than pays for itself, but I do think it's important that, of course, that Revenue look at the actual revenue impact at the time that they make any final decision on the bill, and the bill may need to be amended there as well. So all of that for the record, but I'm very supportive of the policy in terms of where this bill goes. Is there any other discussion on the motion? Okay, if not, Dan's going to call the roll. Representative Carlson, we are voting on a motion to move House Bill 2729 to the Revenue Committee with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Bates?
Aye.
Representative Brown? Excused. Representative Carlson?
Aye.
Representative Devlin?
Aye.
Representative Garrard?
Aye.
Representative Johnson?
Aye.
Representative Pinnell?
Aye.
Representative Crummell?
Aye.
Representative Monis Anderson? Representative Walker?
No.
Representative Witt?
Aye. House Bill 2729 is referred to the Revenue Committee with a due pass recommendation. Close the work session on House Bill 2729. We're going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2979. We can have Mr. Chandler and Mr. Ross, please. Welcome, gentlemen. Go ahead and start whatever order you'd like to.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm John Chandler, the Land Use Specialist for the Oregon Building Industry Association, here on behalf of House Bill 2979. At the outset, I'd like to say it's awfully good to see so many old friends I haven't seen in quite a while who apparently came to see about this bill. What we're intending to do with House Bill 2979 is something very simple. I will grant that the way it got drafted complicates the issue. Let me see if I can clarify it. I was thinking back earlier today, going back to the Goal 5 rule, when LCDC adopted the Goal 5 rule back, I think it was in 1993 or 4. And in that rule, the administrative rule, says that Metro has authority over regional issues, as they should. And when we talked about that in the Goal 5 context, we didn't really discuss what regional in that sense meant. Same thing when the statutes were adopted, also giving Metro and the charter that Metro operates under, also giving them authority over issues of regional significance. And the background noise that I'm bringing to this, in very perhaps oversimplistic terms, was you had issues of statewide significance. In the Metro area, since there is a regional government, you have issues of regional significance. And then within the region and elsewhere around the state, you have issues of local significance. And when we're dealing with natural resource type issues, which is what House Bill 2729 refers to, I was under the impression, my clients were under the impression, that the idea of a regionally significant resource meant something. That it was something less than state resources. It probably wasn't the Cascade Mountain Range, for example, or the coast, but it probably wasn't a wetland in a particular city. It was something more than that. From our standpoint, how things have tended to play out in the metro area has been that everything was considered regionally significant. And I don't think that's too much of an overstatement. What we're attempting to do with House Bill 2979 is to simply provide a definition of what constitutes regional significance. I've seen some of the testimony that has been coming to you in writing. We did not and do not intend this to in any way affect coordination ability. We support coordination. We think that's important. There should be more of it. We don't believe that we're not trying to curtail Metro's authority within what we believe is proper jurisdiction to have jurisdiction over resources. So we do believe that some level of definition of regional significance is necessary. Now, in fairness to Metro, over recent years, they have taken significant steps, probably in the last year and a half, to, if you'll pardon an editorial comment, corral somewhat their planning jurisdiction and be more focused in what they're attempting to do. We support that, we applaud it, we appreciate it. That being said, there is still the lack of a definition. Under the current state of affairs, Metro can decide what is regionally significant. They hopefully will do so with the advice and consent of the local governments within Metro. They don't have to. We believe that it's in the state's interest to help them in the way of defining what regionally significant means. And beyond that, we are not trying with this bill to dictate any particular outcome. We simply think that it will help in the plan exercise of Metro's planning authority. We have been talking to Metro. We'll continue to talk to them. We hope to bring back a bill in front of you that has a little more definition to it and is a little less scary to local government folks who think that we're trying to get rid of regional coordination, but it's not our intent. And Mr. Chairman, I'll be glad to take any questions.
Why don't we go ahead and take Mr. Ross's testimony and then we'll hold for questions at that point.
Okay. Thank you. Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Kelly Ross and I represent the Home Builders Association of Metropolitan Portland. Just to echo John a little bit and provide a little bit more context to the circumstances that gave rise to this piece of legislation. In 1998, Metro adopted their Title III requirements, which were for clean water. It set up a process for imposing 50-foot to 200-foot buffers along all waterways. And it charged the local governments with implementing that. In Washington County, the Home Builders Association, the Audubon Society, virtually every interest group involved in the process came together and put together a implementation program that we all signed off on. Tom Bryan, Washington County Chairman, when this happened, said someone should take note of this because everyone is agreeing on this. It wasn't more than a couple months later that Metro started their Goal 5 process aimed at preserving fish habitat, wildlife, and a long list of other natural resource qualities. And the basic proposal that came out was 200-foot buffers on sides of all streams, intermittent, non-intermittent, seasonal, you name it. Once again, we have been under the impression that regional significance meant something, and we raise the question time and again, if everything is significant, the term has no meaning. If there's nothing that's insignificant, that gets some lesser degree of protection. And that process really didn't slow down until Washington County and all the cities within Washington County put up a red flag and said, we'd like to work on this ourselves and come up with an approach to suggest to Metro. And that's kind of the situation it is now. There is in the works more proposals to protect upland Goal 5 areas. And we're fearful that we're going to see the same thing repeated where everything is considered significant and everything gets the same kind of blanket protection.
What we're trying to do with this bill is put some sideboards on this, the term significant, so that everything isn't treated the same, that we have a common sense approach that considers differing qualities, and allows local governments some respect for the Goal 5 work that they have each done in examining resources within their own communities, differing levels of protection, and not duplicate those processes. So, as John said, we're more than willing to work with Metro and the other local governments in the region to make sure that happens. But we think in the interest of predictability and certainty on this, we have to rein it in a little bit and introduce a little bit more common sense to the process.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Ross. Are there questions for Mr. Chandler or Mr. Ross? Representative Devlin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chandler, if we were talking about transportation corridors, or even if we were talking about open space, it probably would be fairly easy to come up with a definition or at least some guidelines on what would be regionally significant. But if we're talking about preservation of the species and what the reaction here to, I'm having a hard time thinking in my mind about a clear definition. Using an example of, any of the rivers in the metropolitan area, all the rivers probably have tributaries that lead into them. What happens in all of those tributaries actually has an impact on the overall water quality in that river. So how do you really differentiate when you're trying to determine what's regionally significant when you get into this issue, which I think is interesting for me because I hear a lot of the issues relative to setbacks because I actually have a lot of territory along the Tualatin River in my district. But actually, one of the things I've seen over the last 4 or 5 years here is I've been all over the state reacting to endangered species issues. It's nothing unique to the metropolitan area. Any corner of the state is reacting to the issues. And you could get out there and you could say, you know, one size of cattle operation is significant and one is not. But we don't really make that determination either. Any size of cattle operation is significant in terms of its impact and how it's regulated. So I'm just trying to get how we would get a definition of significance.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Devlin, there are several ideas being kicked around on that. One is to try to do so legislatively, which, and I, as I stated, this one needs some work to do that. You could look at crossing jurisdictional boundaries, the size of the watershed involved, the request by the jurisdictions affected, whose territory it lies within. There's also the possibility of letting LCDC take a run at it in rulemaking with legislative direction to do so. That doesn't answer your question directly about what the definition would be, but when we did Goal 5 work, it took, if I remember correctly, the better part of a year and a half or so to try to hash out what the Goal 5 rule ought to say. It does take time to come up with those kind of definitions, and as you point out, complicating this in this particular instance with regard to the hypothetical you raised is the National Marine Fisheries Service, who will have an opinion on what is and isn't significant as well. But if you can, for a moment, leave out the issue of the endangered species and think more about the jurisdiction of a regional government and what their proper role is in the planning process as a interim level between state and local, that's what we're trying to get at here. I think the issue of a definition is one that we could just talk about in further conversation with Metro and bring back to you. It still wouldn't be perfect, no matter what we come up with, because it's going to be incomplete in any given circumstance. But we could get a lot closer than we have right now because there, at the moment, there isn't one.
Mr. Chairman, a follow-up.
Representative Devlin.
In preparing this legislation, Mr. Chandler, was there any discussion, and I'm sure Legislative Council took note of this, I'm just trying to understand this myself, the significance between state statute and the charter itself, because the voters gave Metro the authority to have home rule. The voters approved the charter. Was there any discussion between you and Legislative Council in terms of, you know, which is more dominant? Every city we have, obviously, I think every city we have now is home rule. I think, eight or nine, I think eight of the 36 counties are home rule, and obviously, there's only one metro, and it's now a home rule entity also, so.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Devlin, that was not a conversation I had with the legislative council.
Okay.
Is that the short answer?
Yes, sir.
Representative Montes Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Probably Mr. Chandler. In 1992, the voters were in favor of the home rule. They voted for that. In 1995, they voted to have regional or acquisition of open spaces. And it seems like this legislation is going to do away with what was set up for regional control, regional and local control. How do you respond to that?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Montes Anderson, I'm glad you asked that. Let me state again, absolutely the intent, and I don't think the wording of the bill, frankly, does this, but the intention was never to do away with the coordination that Metro does or to affect what you just set forth as the contract made with the voters in the charter. So we are simply trying to define a term that Metro uses as part of their operating authority, for which there is currently no definition. It doesn't affect the green spaces issue at all. It simply affects Metro's ability to work with its local partners. We have, and many of you know, since you represent areas within the Metro boundary, the home builders have had a love-hate relationship with Metro. But all statements to the contrary notwithstanding, we have never gone after them in a legal sense other than to quarrel with them on appeal about the things they've done. We've supported my predecessor at the Portland Home Builders was on the Charter Committee, for heaven's sake. I mean, we believe regional government is a good thing, and that we try to think of ourselves, I guess, as a loyal opposition. Doesn't mean we agree with them. Doesn't mean we agree with them very often. But we are supportive of regional government. We think it's an important thing, particularly in the metro area where there's such a diversity of jurisdictions contained within the urban growth boundary. All of that. Kumbaya having been said, though, we believe that there is a need, oftentimes a need, for remonstrating with our friends at Metro. This is one example. We believe that some definition of regionally significant would be useful for them and for the people of the region.
Follow up,
Representative.
But don't you think then that, a piece of legislation that is affecting the entire state, whereas there are going to be regional preferences on how they want to deal with streams. And maybe one area and this is local governments and the voters, et cetera, may want the 200-foot boundary. Another area may only want the 50-foot, what is that called?
Buffer.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Montes Anderson, I was going to reply that I don't think that the bill as presently written limits that. It forces a closer working relationship between the regional government and the local governments, and says that if the local governments want to do it on their own, working together or singly, they can. If they don't, they all have the ability to request involvement by Metro. That's the initial approach we took, but as we said before, we're interested in working on other approaches.
Other questions? Representative Crummel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just curious. When Metro put in the 200-foot buffers nationwide, was that prospective in nature, or was that, I'm trying to get a little bit of a handle on what was, John, in your testimony with regards to what Metro had done on the stream buffers and that sort of thing?
Let me answer that for you.
Sure.
Representative Crummel. First of all, the 200-foot was never formally adopted.
Okay.
It was a proposal was put on the shelf for a while, like I said, while Washington County and all the Washington County jurisdictions went back and tried to work on it themselves. But for the most part, it would have been prospective, but it would have affected remodeling projects of existing homes, any kind of structures you may want to put on in your backyard or front yard or wherever that fronted up, that came within that 200 feet if you were near a water or water body. And we certainly heard a lot of concern among property owners about how it was going to affect their ability to manage their own property.
Okay. follow-up, Mr. Chair?
Follow-up, Representative.
So in has there been something adopted now by Metro with regards to stream buffers in the area?
Okay.
So the whole thing is just sitting up while they're still waiting for Washington County to kind of...
Right.
Okay. Wouldn't most of... If that were the adopted standard for the region, wouldn't the city of Portland be in violation and the city of Milwaukee be in violation in several areas?
Well, certainly if you applied it retroactively to construction that had been built previously, but the way the initial proposal was, it was for any new construction or remodeling, it grandfathered in, like, say, the Portland Seawall or the Harbor Place development down there,
mm-hmm.
that was in that 200-foot buffer. But it certainly would limit any future remodeling or additions onto those structures.
And if I may, Mr. Chair, I'm just trying to kind of follow this up a little bit more, because the city, not only would the landowners, for example, with the like Park Place, is that what it's called, Park Place? And those several areas, but also we have a freeway that runs probably within a couple hundred feet of the river on a couple of areas. We have City of Portland has, as we just found out the other day, has lift stations or, excuse me, sewage disposal sites that are right close to the river. If they needed to remodel those, which they're having to upgrade their system now anyway, so if they were to have, if they were trying to upgrade those facilities, that would be considered a remodel. So that, in essence, would put them in violation, wouldn't it? Because don't they have some of those facilities pretty close to the river?
I wouldn't want to venture an opinion on that. I was focusing mainly on the residential commercial development aspects of the rule and not how it affected public facilities.
Okay. Okay, thank you.
Any other questions? Is it in the debate?
Well, this is going to be a question really about basic policy. My understanding of organizations like Metro, they're set up to cover a region where they have overlapping jurisdictions with the same problem. They need some coordination between those two. And by your own letter, you said Metro seems to be doing somewhat better in working with you on environmental issues. I also come from a part of the state where the issue of local control versus state control over land use is an extremely hot item right now. I would have a difficult time returning to the area I come from and say that I voted for a bill that in some way, shape, or form limited local control and it came from the state level. Having said all that, you must still feel this bill is an appropriate bill, even though we understand Metro's job, we understand that they're doing a little better job at it, and this would limit local control to a degree by bringing in state law. Having said that, can you convince me why I should vote for this bill?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Bates, we're quite sensitive to the issue of local control as well. We're not trying to affect Metro as a local government's ability to do their job. They're simply going to define the terms that they use within that. That's something this legislature and every state agency does on a regular basis. I don't mean to make light of your concern at all. I think it's a legitimate one. I appreciate it. But the issue of local control, I mean, if this bill said that Metro could no longer do this and the state was going to define regional significance or LCDC was going to, well, then yes, absolutely, there'd be a raid on local control, and we would have a difficult time selling that to our client. Wouldn't even try, as a matter of fact. But I think what we're trying to do, the best way to put it, is we're simply going to explain what the term means to give Metro some guidance, give the local government some guidance, give property owners guidance. I don't see that personally as an infringement on local control, at least no more so than 90% of the bills that are going to come in front.
Representative Devlin?
Mr. Chairman, to be fair to Mr. Chandler, since actually the inception of Metro, and particularly during the charter process, the debate has always been, to some degree, what is going on a different level here, what is regional and what is local. That's the area of the primary friction between local governments and Metro, both cities, counties, and special districts. And by the way, I appointed your predecessor to the Charter Committee. So.
Uh-huh. Other questions?
Did you really?
Yeah. I have a question on paragraph 7 of the bill, line 27. You have the word shall be limited to those instances that extend across multiple jurisdictions. Is that the best language? Are we better off having language which makes it optional for local jurisdictions to approve or request Metro involvement? This language seems to be prohibitive.
Mr. Chairman, the ultimate responsibility for any for the content of a bill rests with the proponent, and so I will take responsibility for the wording. I did not write it, and I agree with you that is somewhat prohibitive. I'm not sure, frankly, if that was a may shall discussion that's been coming out of Legislative Council this time or my own lack of proofreading. But I agree with you, that is a that sentence reads oddly. And as I said in my testimony, the concept, and we appreciate the hearing on the concept, is what we're interested in, not so much the specifics, but the issue of a lack of definition and a providing some guidance. I agree with you.
How frequently are you aware of that local jurisdictions within the Metro area have complained and been unhappy with Metro's involvement in the specific areas that you're seeking to limit their involvement in? We've got a letter, for example, from Mayor Drake here from the City of Beaverton opposing the bill.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I can tell you that I sat on the Metro Technical Advisory Committee with a lot of other local planners and representatives, and it was a common question that was raised. Why are we doing this again? We've already done Goal 5 planning in our own jurisdictions. Why are we having to go through these hoops again? It was be difficult to find anything formally, any written testimony given on that, but certainly anecdotally and in private conversations, those questions were raised.
So it's your feeling, I guess, then, Kelly, that some of the local jurisdictions that are within the Metro boundary sometimes feel that there's issues that Metro has authority for and gets involved in, or at least gets involved in, that they think could be handled more effectively or more efficiently locally?
Short answer, yes. We saw that in Metro's affordable housing strategy initially when a number of the local governments rebelled against that, and it was eventually worked out, but it took a long process. And even on the Goal 5, as we've said several occasions, that it wasn't until Washington County and all the cities within Washington County put up the caution flag and said we'd like to work on this ourselves that Metro's Goal 5 process slowed down.
So it's your belief that these things would still be done, but they'll be done by local governments and local jurisdictions, as opposed to Metro getting directly involved in them. Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, I believe it would happen both ways. The way the bill is drafted, and even though the language isn't precise, allows for local governments within Metro to ask for Metro to do it. I think that's an appropriate role. Whatever the definition of regional, within the definition of regional significance, Metro would have jurisdiction on its face then to do what they needed to be done. So there'd always be the opportunity for locals to ask for Metro to have some jurisdiction on its own, and then for the locals to continue operating under statewide goals and laws that exist already.
Actually, I think, John, I think the language here shall be limited. It says it shall be limited only when the, in those instances, when the space
right.
is extend across multiple jurisdictions, and then upon request by all affected jurisdictions. So it seems to me if it didn't extend across more than one jurisdiction, this bill would prohibit Metro involvement. Am I reading that right?
I believe you are, yes. I was speaking more from my intent as opposed to the writing.
I understand. I'm not holding you to the exact language of the bill. I mean, I realize you need to work on that, and you mentioned that to me. Okay. Any other questions? Okay. Thank you, gentlemen. Okay. If we could have Councilor Bragdon and Metro Executive Burton. If you want to come up together, that might be most productive. Welcome. Welcome to the committee. Whichever way you'd like to start, we'll be happy to take your testimony.
Okay. Chair Witt, members of the committee, I'm David Bragdon, presiding officer of the Metro Council. I'll go first. Mr. Chandler said he had a love-hate relationship with Metro. We're not sure which of us he loves and which of us he hates, but I'll go first. As presiding officer of the council, I'm elected by my six colleagues to represent the council. So I represent them. I also represent the people who elect me to office. But at Metro, we also are very conscious of our role to another very important constituency, and that's the constituency of local government. This bill really turns on not the relationship between Metro and the citizens or government and property owners generally. This bill really turns on the relationship between Metro and the local governments within our jurisdictions. Everything that we do at Metro relates in some way or another to local government, with the possible exception of running the zoo. That's the one thing that we do pretty much independently. Everything else that we do, whether it's solid waste regulations or land use planning or transportation functions, all of that relates to our relationship with local governments and has great involvement from local governments. That involvement is institutionalized through various committees that we have, primarily the Metro Policy Advisory Committee, which is a collection of county commissioners, mayors, city councilors throughout the region who meet every 2 weeks and advise the council on all major policies. And we listen to them very carefully. It's a recognition that problems in our area overlap sometimes and they connect sometimes, and that having an organization and an organization that deals among different organizations can address problems that do overlap and connect. That's exactly the approach that has characterized our approach to natural resources. It's a collaborative and cooperative one that recognizes that some things overlap and other things connect. It's been referenced earlier to various give and take that's been taking place among ourselves and local governments with regards to various proposals. I'm not purporting to speak for local governments, including Washington County, which was referenced earlier. They can speak for themselves, and I think they will, on this bill. What I can tell you is that all of them have been involved, and all of them have been supportive of the efforts that we've undertaken in this approach. With regard specifically to regional significance, which is the crux of this bill, a working group is underway for us in the region working at all levels of government to define that term. And the proponents of this bill, in fact, are more than invited to participate in that very complicated policy discussion that we think should take place at the local and regional level rather than at the state level. And that's the definition of regional significance. Those are my comments, and I'll turn it over to my colleague, Mr. Burton.
I think we'll hold questions until Mr. Burton gives his testimony, if that's okay.
Thank you, Chairman. With members of the committee, it's a pleasure to be down here, especially on this side of the dais. I just want to iterate what Councilor Bragdon said, and really want to clarify one thing that was said here by Mr. Ross about the proposed Goal 5 measures that he brought up regarding the 200-foot buffers, which has been one of the things that seems to be the bugbear in a lot of things that are being said. First of all, Metro put out a draft plan last December on how we're going to approach streamside protection and habitat protection in the region. Part of the basis for that was taking a look at what we thought and assumed from signals we got from the National Marine Fisheries Service was going to be effective on the ESA. Mr. Chandler said, if you take the ESA out of this, then you can't. The fact is you can't take the ESA out of this question because fish and wildlife and water don't respect jurisdictional boundaries. The watershed runs across those things. So we looked at this and said NMFS is likely to come along with a 200-foot buffer, and what the draft plan said was if you adopt the 200-foot buffer, you're probably going to be safe from anything going down as far as take goes from a provision that might be provided locally or under federal law. The fact is that we also said very clearly in there we know not 200-foot buffers aren't going to work for everybody, so what you need to do is intensively manage within that 200-foot and come up with some local plans to figure that out. Councilor Bragdon and I then, after the first of the year, went to Washington County Chairman Tom Bryan and suggested that under Title III, which was also referenced here in the process that Washington County used there, that Washington County and the Unified Sewer Agency, which has deals with a lot of the water aspects in Washington County, may want to use the same process that they had for Title III and approached in their approach to Goal 5. And Chairman Bryan agreed to that, and that's the process that we're going through. We've also done it with other counties and collections of cities. And you'll hear in a minute from our local jurisdictions what those jurisdictions have done in approaching this. We are really in about a one-and-a-half-year timeline before we expect to adopt any specific regulations regarding the setbacks or anything dealing with Goal 5 habitat. The metropolitan area is one of the most polluted ones in the state. We probably cause more pollution in a week than most of the rest of the rural jurisdictions do in months. And we need to get our act together to address the whole question of the way in which we're listed under both endangered species and the fact that we have some super sites right inside the Portland Harbor. Those are part of what we're trying to get at. And we're doing it with local jurisdictions, not simply by trying to come up with a fiat from down the ways. This bill, the way it's written right now, effectively rewrites our charter. You'll notice in Section 1 of the bill, it says subject to the provisions of the district charter, district may, and this is our home rule charter provisions. And then in Section 1, Subsection 7, it says notwithstanding the provisions of the charter. And I would ask you as a matter of policy whether you really want to be rewriting home rule charters this way, because one at a time somebody might march in here and say, here's something we object to. I don't know where the definition of regional significance is in this bill that the proponents of it are advocating for here, but I don't see it. What this simply says is it takes away local jurisdictional control under the home rule charter to, in fact, carry out what the people voted for under the charter in the first place. With those comments, I'll close and... We have some folks coming up. I'm glad to answer any questions, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, thank you. Questions for either of these two witnesses? Representative Mona Sanderson?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Just for the record, I'd like you to tell us how many, appeals we've had regarding issues that have come up with I heard this morning that for instance, the urban growth boundary has expanded 4,000 acres, and there's only 100 acres that have actually been appealed, that type of thing. I just want to get a handle of what kind of problems are we talking about.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Representative Mona Sanderson, over the Metropolitan Service District has actually been in place since 1979. It's under Home Rule Charter since 1995. There have been individual cases of jurisdictions that have objected to expansions or, in some cases, non-expansion of an urban growth boundary in very specific cases around the state. I don't know the number of those, David, you might know, but the figure 4,000 acres is approximately what the council brought in the last round of expansions. We've actually expanded the urban growth boundary over 35 times in a period of 20 years, adding approximately 7,000 acres to the urban growth boundary. The last round, most of the objections were cases where the boundary was not moved in, but there were jurisdictions, Stafford Basin, for example, where some local jurisdictions had objected to that, and those have been referred to LUBA or remanded back to us. So those specific cases go back and forth. But generally on policy issues, and one was brought up about affordable housing, when Metro took on the affordable housing question and took it up as a matter of policy, local jurisdictions said, wait a minute, what is your policy on this? We all sat down around a table again and said, let's work out something here. And the last, we finally adopted an affordable housing goals and objectives for the region that was agreed upon by local jurisdictions. So none of these things are easy to come by. When you're dealing with a complex jurisdictional area, and you have lots of different pieces, but you want to do a coordinated plan. For example, trying to figure out what's a stream corridor protection that runs across jurisdictional lands. Different jurisdictions have different codes and zones. You have to sit down and figure out how we're going to work this out to the benefit of everyone. But for the most part, I can't think of, other than specific land use cases, about 100 acres, where there has been any cases that have been contested. NEPTA does have the authority within its charter to do these things, but we've never taken a local jurisdiction to court.
Okay, a follow-up. I guess the point, and I think you've answered it, the point is there's been a lot of good regional planning by Metro with a small amount of problems, and it seems like it's the land use problems. I want to make sure that that's right, because I know that there's the discrepancy. I mean, there's discrepancies with the groups here.
Yeah, Chair Witt, Representative Thomas Anderson, I think I would agree with you in that often I feel like if you go to an appeal, whether you win or lose, in a sense you've already lost. And the fact that we've had few, if any, appeals in this natural resource green space protection area is a product of working together beforehand, so it doesn't get to the point where a local government is appealing. And that having committees like we do with the Policy Advisory Committee, that we work through differences, and there's no secret that there are differences, but that's part of getting to a reasonable answer, that those accommodations and compromises are made within the regional framework at the big table that we have, rather than being appealed. So the fact that there haven't been many appeals, to me, is a sign that we're working things out as we should be at the regional table.
Thank you.
Other questions? Representative Crummell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Welcome. The question that I have, it has to do with the concept that was talked about by the proponents a few minutes ago, and what your response to that might be. Is it, would it be, yeah, let's talk about it, or, you know, hell no, or somewhere in between?
Mr. Chairman, what Representative Crummell, as Mr. Chandler outlined, sometimes they view themselves as the loyal opposition, and I guess that's, you know, it helps keep their, well, I don't know who pays for their gas getting down here, but I know who pays for mine. This is a matter that we'd be glad to discuss. We've actually in discussion. The whole question of what's the regional significance, I think, is more down to what size of a body of water is it that we're talking about trying to protect, and I think there's some debate over that. Clearly, the Willamette, I would hope people would all agree that's of regional significance. So is the Tualatin, and so is the Clackamas Rivers. The feeder streams into those then become very important. Representative Devlin referred to the fact that all of these are interrelated wetlands that usually are large in size, and the whole area of approaching how you protect those. The idea of saying, well, each jurisdiction should figure that out for themselves, belies the fact the metropolitan area is very interrelated. It has the same transportation system, the same marketing system, the same labor pool. It shares, in fact, a larger one than just inside our jurisdiction. It goes beyond that. And so in order to deal with the habitat protection that we think is necessary and to sort of clean up our act up there, we have to look at those interjurisdictionally. Where does the water come from? Getting down to a stream that's within a specific boundary within a specific jurisdiction might be the issue they're talking about, but I think we would be glad to discuss that with them and find out if there's some common ground for resolving whatever their issue is. Quite frankly, I'm still not sure what it is.
Thank you. Any other questions? For either of you, do you sense that there's an undue amount of tension between local governments and Metro relative to these types of issues? Or do you think the working relationship is generally very good?
Chairman, what members of the committee, I spend probably 90% of the time that I'm not inside the district being asked to speak at areas from Montreal to San Diego to Fort Worth. And what amazes the local jurisdictions in those areas is the amount of cooperation that we do have in the Portland metropolitan area. It is significance that has a history that goes back 25 years that I won't bore you with all the details of that. I often liken it to and other mayors, and in a moment you'll have some folks testifying who are mayors and county commissioners to talk to you, to address you on the same question. I don't know what it is that managed to achieve that over a period of time, but part of it's coming to the table. As Councilor Bragdon mentioned, we provide the table. We provide the questions sometimes, and we seek the answers jointly. And sometimes the impact meetings, the Metropolitan Planning Advisory Committee meetings, where all these jurisdictions sitting together remind me of a giant family that sits down to try to sort out Uncle George's will. There's a lot of differences of opinion, but ultimately everybody comes out with the right answer, and that's what we're about. And I would say that we are, if anything that is particular or unique about the metropolitan area, is the high degree of cooperation that exists between jurisdictions. doesn't mean there's some rivalries and this sort of thing, but I think it's outstanding.
Chair Witt, you asked if I felt there's undue tension between metro and regional governments. The answer to that is no, not at all. There's not undue tension. Is there often debates back and forth where one jurisdiction or another has different opinions? Absolutely. That's perfectly natural. But that's the point of why we exist, and the fact that those discussions take place regionally, I think in and of itself is a pretty significant achievement. And the fact that we do come up with policies that do get subscribed to, as referenced earlier by the lack of appeals coming out of those, I think is a sign that the tension gets resolved where it should be.
Sure. Thank you. Any other questions?
Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you, sir.
Appreciate you coming down and giving your testimony. If we could have Commissioner Nato and I believe Mr. Williams from the city of Oregon City, why don't you come up together and... You want to go ahead and start, Lisa?
All right. Thank you. Good afternoon. For the record, I'm Lisa Nato, Multnomah County Commissioner, and I'm also here speaking in my capacity as chair of the Local Government Advisory Committee to Metro, which has been referenced earlier, MPAC. I'm here to oppose 2979. I consider this a proposed solution to a problem that does not exist, and I think it undermines really the regional goals we're trying to accomplish in our area. The voters passed a measure, and the local government supported a measure giving Metro the power to deal with issues of regional concern. It's very true that we have tension between local governments and Metro. Quite often, we do. There is no question that there is tension between what we desire as local governments who have to implement the rules that Metro sets out. That tension is healthy, but I would like to tell you that I've looked at other proposed regional governments around the country. We do land use planning and regional planning. We are the best in this country. Yes, we're inventing it as we go along, and sometimes it's a great struggle. But there is no one else, because in every other jurisdiction where they don't have an elected body to make the final decision, each individual jurisdiction can hang up the entire process for the rest of the group that wants to move forward in a way and deal with regional matters. And that is why I believe this bill is extremely dangerous. At MPAC, we are the Local Government Advisory Committee. We meet, as was said, twice a month for 2 hours each time and more meetings if they're necessary. And we hammer out our differences, which are extremely different around the region. There are 27 local governments that are represented at that table and all three counties. And it's not always easy. But I strongly believe that your proposed legislation will undermine our efforts. I would like to go through an example of the 200-foot buffer and how we dealt with the proposed Streamside Corridor. That draft was a document issued by Metro staff as a draft document over a year ago. In a sense, that's similar to filing a bill in the legislative session. It's the first step in what later becomes a very involved process. I will show you that where we are in this process is we have adopted a vision statement, and I will hand this to you for a draft Streamside program outline. And you can read through this vision statement, and I'd also give to you a copy of how this vision statement then was passed unanimously at the MPAC Local Government Advisory Committee to Metro. We are just beginning the process of fine-tuning and getting to the legislative point of how we will, in fact, protect our streams and our wildlife in the region. I believe that it should be up to us, the local government, to hammer out our protections for natural resources and recognize that we don't always agree, but in all the major decisions that I've been involved with at Metro, we have ultimately worked long and hard and generally come to a consensus for our region. So I'd like you to let us decide among ourselves how to protect our natural resources and continue the commitment that we made to be at the table and provide regional planning for our area, a commitment that the voters have approved. And it's not always easy, but I firmly believe we are doing a better job than anyone else in this country, and I ask you not to change that. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there any questions for Commissioner Nato? Do you want to put your hand up there? Representative Garrard has a question. Go ahead, Representative.
Commissioner Nadel, nice to see you again. You made the, we were listening to the comments from Metro, and they were saying that they are not dictating anything in this process. I'm somewhat very similar to Representative Bates from the standpoint in my neck of the woods, regional governments get county commissioners recalled. It's not a very popular thing. But you made a comment that Metro has the power to deal with, and that kind of tipped in my mind a little bit. Could you elaborate a little bit more on that?
Well, Metro, under the charter that was passed by our voters, has the authority to work on matters that are of regional concern. And that is a definition that we grapple with. Sometimes different jurisdictions may have different opinions on what's regional or not. But I really believe it's something that we should be able to hammer out. Certainly we can sue Metro if we don't agree with the definition of something, a measure that's passed, but they have gone beyond their authority in doing that. But so far it hasn't come to that. We've been able to hammer out our differences, so it hasn't been litigious, or we would probably be the first ones to step up and try to abolish Metro.
Follow-up, Mr. Chair?
Follow-up.
So just to clarify in my mind, if Metro tells the Multnomah County Commissioners this is the way it is, then that is the way it is?
If it's a matter that's allowable under its charter.
Thank you.
Okay. Other questions? Thank you, Commissioner. Mr. Williams?
All right. I'm John F. Williams, Jr. I'm the mayor of Oregon City. I came here terribly confused by reading that bill. I thought at first, well, it does decimate Metro, and I sure don't want that to happen. Then I heard the industry representative say, well, no, it's not about that. It's just about some definitions. And then the home builder stepped in, and I know exactly where they're going as far as I'm concerned. Oregon City was the first city of any consequence in the metro area to adopt Title III. We ran through it and did it. It took a lot of time, a lot of energy, and a lot of money, but we believed in it. We also extended Title III beyond what was requested by Metro because as we looked at it, we realized that 200 feet was better than 50 feet in a lot of cases. Now, we're engaged now in trying to plan our waterfront, and the question that Representative Crummell asked about the 200-foot, it's true. But it's not Metro that's going to dictate that to us, the feds. They're going to say, don't touch those fish. And the state fish and wildlife people have already been to examine our plan or look at and testify, say, don't touch those fish. And so it's not just a matter of a Metro telling us what to do. It's others who are translating those laws into impact on Oregon City. But just a short example of why I think it's absolutely necessary to have cross-jurisdictional rules and regulations. I was standing out on the bank of the Clackamas here about 3 weeks ago when the water's low. It was about 7:45, 8 o'clock in the morning. Traffic's roaring by, and I look up and I see across the river from Gladstone comes a deer. And he walks down to the water and he swims across, or actually walked across because the water's so low, and he comes up into Oregon City. He's already crossed one boundary. In fact, he crossed two because the state probably has control of the river. And then he went on up the hill through Newell Canyon, which probably has a lot of county property in as well as private property. He may have even gotten to Molalla, which is another jurisdiction. But that son of a gun, he didn't know that. And he doesn't care whether I don't want him to cross my property or not. And I couldn't control him if I wanted to. So it's absolutely necessary that we work with Gladstone and the state and Molalla and all the rest of them to solve the problems of protecting that poor young man and the other birds and animals that move from downtown Portland even, come out that corridor, right up Newell Canyon, and keep on going. It's a great thing. If we destroy it, we're in big trouble. So I agree with what Metro's been doing. I appreciate their efforts. We don't have much tension. Once in a while, one commissioner says, hey, they're telling us what to do again. They don't give us any money. But when you look at it, it's actually the state that's telling us what to do and doesn't give us any money.
You can count on that continuing.
I serve on the South Corridor Traffic Study, and it's been a delightful experience. It really has, in cooperative efforts guided by the Metropolitan Government. It wouldn't have happened, and I don't want to use these words, SOL, the crude way. It's sort of out of luck if we didn't have Metro, because Oregon City is small. We'd be trampled on by all of those big guys.
We barely managed to get our share fighting through the metro process, but we do. We get a share we wouldn't get otherwise. So there may be tensions, but by golly, I think all of us in Oregon City, that is, those who are working closely with Metro, understand it's necessary. And if this bill does gut it, I certainly hope you'll turn it down. If it's just about definitions, why, maybe we can work it out. But I don't think so. I think you ought to turn this bill back, because it's going to turn the clock back a lot in Oregon City. Thank you.
Any questions for Mayor Williams? Thank you, Mayor.
Yeah,
Representative Walker has a question or a comment?
Well, I just have a comment. Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's the most engaging testimony I've heard today. You are a kick. I really have enjoyed your presentation.
Thank you very much.
My name is Charlotte Lehan. I'm the mayor of Wilsonville, and I guess I didn't get my name on your list, but another mayor in the region, and I guess if Oregon City is small, then I don't know what to say we are.
You have more property value than we do.
Possibly. Wilsonville is one of the fastest growing cities of the 23 inside of Metro's jurisdiction, and as such, we have been deeply involved with Metro for years and years in terms of planning and transportation and certainly open space. And for the most part, things have worked very well with them. There are a lot of things that we're able to do with Metro that we wouldn't be able to do without them. Certainly when you're looking at the ESA rules and the dealing with habitat and watershed issues, those are things that are very difficult for small jurisdictions with limited staff and resources to come up with a plan that will satisfy National Marine Fisheries, that will satisfy the state's Goal 5, and we're able to work with Metro and come up with documents and plans that will work for us and work for the region. We just finished our natural resources plan, which combined Title 3, Goal 5, and the 4D rules from the feds. And that document just passed our local jurisdiction, and it's on its way to second reading in April. And it was a couple-year effort to get to that point, not only working with Metro, but with our local citizens, and we got to the point when it passed that we were down to only one citizen, one property owner, who still had differences with us in the plan. And so it sort of shows you what can happen as you work through these processes. And I think this bill, of course, I'm a little confused, like John is, on the description I heard of it isn't what I'm reading here, because what I'm reading here is pretty onerous and, in fact, appears to legislate that Metro can't coordinate with us unless everyone else in the region agrees and asks them to coordinate with us. It looks like any jurisdiction that doesn't could stop all the rest from doing any coordinating with Metro. I mean, the wording in this is terrible. So I don't know. It doesn't say anything here about regional significance. And I can tell you on the 200-foot buffer issue, which is always used as the boogeyman in this discussion, our understanding of that from the beginning was that that was the safe zone. If you were going to do something, that would certainly cover your requirements under NIMS. If you were going to do something less than that, you need to have justification. And so in our natural resources plan, our stream buffers range from 50 feet all the way to more than 200. Some of them are 250, 280 feet, depending on the circumstance and where it is. And we feel like our plan is justified, and we've done the science behind it, and we'll stand behind it. But it's a range of distances. We were never told that we had to have 250 or 200-foot buffers. I do want to also point out, you heard from Mayor Drake in written testimony. You've heard he of course is in the Tualatin watershed, and Mayor Williams is in the Clackamas watershed in Clackamas County. Wilsonville's a little bit unique in that we straddle both those counties, and we're not in anybody else's watershed but our own, other than the Willamette River. Our streams are wholly contained inside our boundaries. We don't share them with anybody else. And if anybody was here to complain and say we want to do it all by ourselves, it should be us, because we have no reason to cooperate other than sharing the Willamette with any other jurisdiction. and yet Metro has been very helpful throughout the whole process, and we couldn't have gotten through without them. And just to sort of wrap this up, I think that one of the issues that is a problem in the area, and I don't think you'll hear it from local governments complaining about Metro, what you see continuing to be a problem or a growing problem in the area is an anti-growth sort of backlash that has gone through and completely overturned some of the local governments around here and across the state and created a lot of problems. And I think when you see a big anti-growth backlash from the citizens, and that's where it rises up from, it's because we haven't paid enough attention to the things that protect the quality of life that make people okay with the growth. And so we need to do that. We need to take care of the open space and the parks and the resources that we have, the things that people moved here for in the first place. If we don't take care of them, you can easily predict that there will be this anti-growth backlash, and that's very difficult. As a local official, for me to be able to continue to support and accommodate growth, I know I can only go so far as my citizens will allow me to do that, and what they'll require is that I take care of their quality of life, and then they'll tolerate growth. I would say this is an unnecessary, definitely unnecessary intrusion on the state's part into local and regional government.
Well, we'd be interested in input from all of you should they come back with some amendments and tighten this up and get to this issue of significant issue. We'd be interested in your input as folks who are working elected leaders in local government to give input to a bill that might be significantly amended. Should that happen? Are there any questions? Thank you. We appreciate all of you coming to the Capitol today and giving your testimony on this bill. Mr. Cafori.
Mr. Chairman of the committee, I don't believe in beating dead horses, so I'll be very brief. My name is Stephen Cafori. I'm here this afternoon representing the 10,000 members of the Audubon Society of Portland. Excuse me, I want to let you know that it's not just local governments, cities, counties, and special districts that work together in the metro region, but also organizations, interest groups like the Audubon Society and the home builders, and a lot of individual citizens. There's a lot of folks making metro work. When we looked at this bill, we were totally baffled by it. It seemed to be a solution begging for a problem, and you've heard enough about that. I still think, Mr. Chair, bringing it back and amending it and trying to get at what they said they were trying to get at in the first place is additionally going after a problem in search of a solution in search of a problem. If there is a definition that needs to be done of regional, and I don't think there's a new issue, it started ever since regional government first started back with Craig back in the olden days, the best people to decide that are the people there. It seems a little strange to us that the Home Builders of Oregon is coming to the state legislature asking the state legislature to give a definition of region so that the people in the metropolitan area of Portland can figure out what they're going to do to take care of themselves. So we suggest that not only do you ignore this bill, Mr. Chair, but I wouldn't waste any more time in trying to get back and fixing it because I don't think the concept is fixable.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Cafori. Any questions? That's pretty definitive. Thank you.
You know, Mr. Chair.
Representative Walker.
Thank you. Most people tell me that I tell it like it is, but today.
You feel good about the hearing today, don't you?
Yeah.
Representative Cromwell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would just point out that I've been in local government both pre-Metro Charter and post-Metro Charter, and Metro is much more responsive to local government and to the needs of the region in terms of working collaboratively with local government post-Charter than they were pre-Charter.
Okay. Thank you, Representative. Representative Devlin.
Mr. Chairman, if I might comment also just briefly, I think you know, you could make an analogy between the debate that we often have in this building between what's a statewide interest and what's an issue of local control. And I think that Metro often has that same debate, but on a slightly different level of what's regional significance and what's an issue of local control. And what's interesting to me is I think since Metro's inception about 22 years ago, that's been the debated issue. It was debated during the charter process, and it's been debated ever since. I don't know if you can really come up with a clear definition of regional significance. I would like to point out, just to be fair to the proponents of the legislation, that Metro's 22 years of history has not been without controversy, and it has not been without a lot of disagreement between parties, but disagreement is sometimes beneficial. But when Metro has chosen to use its authority, I think the times it's gotten in trouble is when it has failed to use its authority judiciously. I mean, I'll give you an example. Probably the one that people most cite about Metro is the transportation process through JPAC. Tell somebody, get them a definition of who the MPO is in the Portland metropolitan area. You'll have to probably try to define it by history, because in one sense it's actually the Metro Council, but in the other sense it's JPAC. And the agreement has basically been there is that there has to be agreement between parties. And JPAC, the Joint Policy Advisory Committee on Transportation, is cities, counties, the Port of Portland, and a few others. And basically, it takes an enormous amount of work to get consensus on an issue. But I always recall that I used to chair JPAC at one time, and people would remark that we would go in for a meeting, and some people would complain about this, that the meetings would go very swiftly because, to a large extent, the decisions had already been made, and that's true. There had been an enormous amount of work beforehand in trying to resolve all the differences between the various interests in the metropolitan area, and actually we were going there to basically, in a sense, ratify the decisions. But I think you'll see examples over the history of Metro where its best examples of where it's achieved is where it's worked closely with local government. Its worst examples are where it's chosen to use its limited authorities less than judiciously. So if the proponents of the bill want to continue to work on it, I would wish them luck, but in 22 years, no one's found an exact definition of regional significance, and I don't expect them to find one in 3 months.
Maybe, Representative, you can convene a work group on this.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Canope?
I just wanted to request Representative Devlin's testimony in writing. He could do that for
me. Before or after he convenes the work group?
Doesn't matter to me.
Okay. Is there anybody else that would like to give testimony on House Bill? Give me the number. 2979. Before we close the public hearing. Okay, I will close the public hearing. Thank you, everybody, for your testimony. We appreciate you coming to the Capitol today and giving testimony. We're going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2980 and ask Mr. Chandler to come forward.
Well, I hope this one has a better
reception. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Again, for the record, John Chandler, Land Use Specialist, Oregon Building Industry Association. I think that last hearing went rather well, don't you? My golly. Here on behalf of House Bill 2980, which hopefully will go somewhat more smoothly, this bill deals with system development charges. And my testimony on this is being circulated to you. This is as much a progress report as it is a hearing on the bill. A little bit of background. We got into this briefly last week during another fund hearing we had in this committee. System development charges are allowed under Oregon law for water, sewer, storm drainage, transportation, and parks. We worked with the local governments in 1989 in adopting the SDC law in the first place. It was a loads of fun process all by itself. And since that time, we've had a form of partnership with local government. We don't like SDCs particularly, the folks I represent, but we understand that they're necessary to put infrastructure on the ground. Oftentimes they're the only funding source available for the infrastructure needed for new development. Local governments, taken for the most part, don't much like SDCs either. They're not a particularly efficient way to raise money, but they are, in many cases, again, the only way there is to get the necessary infrastructure built. So we've had a working relationship with them that started back in 89, 12 years ago, continues to this day. Amendments to the FCC law are infrequent. This is the first bill that's been brought forward, I believe, in three sessions. And we have tried and will continue to try to work with local governments. It's my hope and expectation that when we bring forward a set of Dash 1 amendments to this bill, it will be with the full support of local government. So it will not be contentious. It is not in my client's interest, nor in local government's interest, to have a series of fights over something that is mutually essential as system development charges. But just to give you a sense of the direct, what we're trying to get, what we're talking about in this bill, I put in the bullet points in my written testimony. We're working on language that will clarify that SDCs must relate to the impact of development. Frankly, all of us thought that was implicit in the language of the statute, but there have been a couple of cases that indicate that perhaps we should make it a little bit more explicit. How to build greater accountability in the system for FCC revenues once collected. Clarifying the relationship between improvement fees, which is a term of art. The improvement fees are fees generated by development that go to build new facilities, a new sewage treatment plant, for example, versus reimbursement fees. Reimbursement fees, another term of art, those are fees collected that go to pay the local government back for the sewage treatment plant they already built that has extra capacity. So they're both putting infrastructure in place, but they're treated differently in the law. We're working on language that will clarify that relationship. Clarifying the relationship between the methodology adopted to support a system development charge and the project list adopted. Now, this is one I'm frankly somewhat embarrassed, since I work with SDCs on both the local level and the state level. I would have sworn and bet real money that you had to have a capital improvements plan in place before you adopted a system development charge. Those of you who are local government folks on the commission, I suspect, thought the same thing. Turns out you don't. The way the statute is written, you can adopt an SDC and then figure out what you're going to spend it on. That's kind of doing it backwards. We'll probably fix that. We're working on language to do that in this bill. We're going to have additional notice provided. Right now, under the current law, SDCs are challenged when they're adopted by the local government through what's called a writ of review. In other words, it's a court proceeding on the local record. The current deadlines in the laws are frankly too short for those of us who are interested in system development charges to be able to review the methodology and make comments. We've got agreement so far to extend those deadlines so we have more time to work on it. We'll be working on language that deals with how to challenge an SDC after it's adopted, not the adoption itself, but as it's applied to a particular piece of property. We're going to be putting in language by which a local government can, clarifying how a local government builds in an escalator, such as a construction cost index or something of that sort, so that they can have a factor in their SDC to allow for increases without the need to go back and have further notice, but also to put some limits on what that escalator can be. And finally, under current law, every kind of SDC can be bankrupted, with the exception of Parks SDCs. None of us know why parks aren't bankruptable. I know personally of several parks SDCs that are being bankrupted, but they're not supposed to be. So we're going to close that loophole. My friends in local government that I've been working with on this, I very much appreciate their hard work. We've had a number of meetings. We are close to language that we can bring back. They're sitting behind me. I hope they'll nod their heads. I'm saying the right things in the right order. There we go. Very good.
I'm getting some nods.
and quite seriously, this is the type of bill that the reason we didn't bring many of the concepts in this bill have been kicking around for several sessions. We didn't bring them forward because at one point, for example, Major 50 was going through this building. It wasn't the time to talk to local government about money stuff. They were busy swallowing blood pressure pills. And we try and sincerely try to work with them as a partner in this. Some tasks we both find somewhat distasteful of figuring out how to work with SDCs. We will bring back amendments, Mr. Chairman. We hope the bill will fly through here in good order. I'd be glad to take any questions.
And you're hopeful, John, these amendments will have the support of local governments that would be impacted by these changes in the law.
Mr. Chairman, it's my intention as a proponent of the bill to bring back a unanimous package. At the very least, we hope to be able to come back to you and say we agree on 80% or 90% or 95%, here is the area that we'd like your help deciding. But it's our intent to get unanimous.
Okay, well, great.
Mr. Chair.
Questions? Representative Walker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chandler, when you come back with these amendments, are they going to have school SDCs in there?
That last hearing must have damaged my my senses, Mr. Chairman. I just heard there's something about school SDCs.
This has a very narrow relating clause, Representative. I don't...
Normally, Representative Walker, I bring my crucifix and garlic when we have that conversation.
I just thought I'd sort of get you jump started for the evening.
Well, I haven't had enough fun. Thank you.
Any other questions for Mr. Chandler?
Oh, Mr. Chairman, if I may, I did promise people one thing, and I apologize for this. On page one of the bill, line 16, current loss is transportation. We propose changing that to construction and improvement of roads and streets. I know very well that we cannot hang on to that. The word transportation will be restored in any final amendment that comes before you. It is simply our intention to call attention to the fact that SDC revenue is being spent on things that are not roads and streets, such as trolleys.
I kind of like that change.
I understand that, Mr. Chairman, and we can talk about a minority report, perhaps.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Devlin.
Mr. Chairman, that definition is even narrower than what we can actually use highway dollars for that are generated in the state. So.
That's another hearing, Representative Devlin. You're absolutely right.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm going to let Representative Knob take over the meeting because I have to go to a meeting. So, Representative.
Thank you. This committee, Jer. Jacob Rostuff, Thousand Friends. He's actually the last witness, so we are pretty close to adjournment, I think.
Is this the last bill?
I believe it is.
This is it.
What about 2210?
Yeah, what about 2210?
Amendments aren't ready.
Can't ask them.
Oh.
Please, go ahead.
Good afternoon, Chair, members of the committee. I'm Jacob Rostoff. I'm the transportation advocate for 1,000 Friends of Oregon. As you probably know, 1,000 Friends of Oregon is a private nonprofit corporation that works to improve, defend, and enforce the state and local laws adopted to manage growth in Oregon cities, towns, and countryside. I want to speak briefly about House Bill 2980. I appreciate the opportunity to testify today. And I want to speak primarily to the harmful impacts that the bill in its current form, notwithstanding the amendments that Mr. Chandler just discussed, will have on Oregon's transportation system and communities. I also want to talk briefly about the damage it will do to our parks, green spaces, and the recreational opportunities as well, and draw your attention to the connection between parks and recreational infrastructure and having a robust multimodal transportation system. First of all, we feel that House Bill 2980 imposes unnecessary and harmful restrictions on how local governments can meet the needs of their citizens. In a time of increasingly tight local budgets and shrinking state and federal transportation dollars, we feel that local governments need flexibility in order to provide transportation infrastructure, parks, open space, recreational facilities, and other kinds of infrastructure designed to deal with the impacts of growth. As it's written, House Bill 2980 reduces that flexibility. Secondly, it's very important for young, elderly, and mobility-impaired Oregonians to have multiple modes of transportation available to them. That includes things like the pedestrian transportation systems, the sidewalks and trails, bicycle paths and bicycle trails, and as well as transit. We also feel that there's a connection between green space and recreational infrastructure and the transportation system, so that if you have a transportation system with multiple kinds of pathways and bikeways available to pedestrians and bicyclists, you not only improve environmental quality, air quality, water quality, decrease congestion, integrate transportation and exercise, promote compact and efficient urban form, but you also are providing choices for Oregonians, and we feel that's very important. There's some growing public health data that links the access to pedestrian and bicycle infrastructure to better public health outcomes, healthier communities, lower risks of certain kinds of disease like heart disease. And so we feel it's important for our local communities to be able to continue to build these kinds of systems. Restricting transportation system development charges, as this bill currently does, so that they can only be spent on roads and streets will needlessly make it more difficult for local governments to provide these important choices for their citizens. Finally, I just want to point out that roads represent the bulk of our transportation infrastructure right now, and pedestrian and bicycle improvements as well as recreational improvements are typically much less expensive than equivalent investments in roads. So since SDC dollars can buy many more miles of sidewalks and bike paths than roads, shifting this kind of small percentage of total transportation expenditure will not create substantially more roads, but it will substantially reduce locally funded development of pedestrian, bicycle, and transit facilities. Finally, I just want to thank you for your consideration of our comments and reemphasize that we urge you to vote no on this bill as it's currently presented to you, because we feel that voting no will provide greater transportation and recreational choices for all of our Oregonians and promote the health of our communities. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions from the committee? Thank you very much. Actually, we have one more testifier, Liz Frankel, if you wanted to testify.
Actually, I think you can probably read it.
Okay.
I gather there's probably not changes. I doubt that we probably will necessarily follow them, but
Well, thank you very much. Come and testify anytime. That's great. We love it when people are concise. Anyone else wishing to testify on this bill? Seeing and hearing none, we will close the public hearing. And Dan, anything for the good of the committee?
There are still some snacks left, and Wednesday is Motor Vehicle Day. Six buildings.
And Friday is a day off.
In district day.
For some people.
Hey, I'll be here.
Committee adjourned.
Thank you.
We'll be posting next week's agendas.